For this part of the show, let's kind of wade into, I call it again, my organic matters science factoids. I decided to name one portion of my show that because most of what you hear, or most of what you see on TV, isn't necessarily backed up by any facts. People just mouth off, and if you go look up three, and this is something that I was taught, whether I'm getting a bid on a water well or I'm going to read something scientific, find out three sources that actually either match or say, hey, this isn't true, and you've got yourself a pretty good idea. But most of these nuts on TV and radio, they just, somebody says it and they just believe it, or somebody sends it to them in the email and they just accept it, and they don't look at anything. They don't have a clue. So these things I have looked up. It's pretty just general, usually biological science. I'm not trying to get into the politics of even our environment. But since we have a bunch of idiots, mostly politicians, that are making decisions about our environment without having any idea what the hell they're talking about, then I almost can't not cross that line. So this is kind of part of it. This happens to be an old fellow that was actually a diehard Republican. His name was T. Boone Pickens. But Pickens, first he was a corporate oil raider all most of his life. I think he's worth about $500 million when he passed away about a year ago, September 2019. But even though I didn't always follow his politics, he was very looking forward into the future, not just about petroleum, which he did realize was limited at some point. He ended up divesting his money, believe it or not, in the end, into a tremendous amount of wind energy. But his other great statement was, one thing we're going to run out of and one thing we can't have too much of is water. And he bought a bunch of water rights in his day because he knew where it was going. Well, now this particular factoid has something to do with water that I think he'd have been glad to have heard of had he made it to this year. I think he would have appreciated this particular upcoming factoid. We're now learning to use CO2 to convert seawater into drinking water. A chemist at the University of Copenhagen has invented a technology that uses just carbon dioxide to convert seawater into drinking water within minutes. This desalination technology has the potential to replace electricity with CO2 and be used in survival gear and even in large-scale industrial plants in places where people just don't have a source for clean drinking water. Over 800 million people worldwide lack access to clean drinking water on a regular basis, and that number is growing rapidly. Seawater is a vital source of drinking water in many parts of the world, but desalination faces the major challenge of being highly energy intensive right now, mostly with electricity. Desalination plants use huge amounts of fossil fuel generated electricity and therefore make clean water, but they also contribute to our climate change problems. The Copenhagen technology is reminiscent of a soda stream machine that had become kind of common. Carbon dioxide is added to water, initiating a chemical reaction. But instead of using it for bubbly carbonation, it's used to separate the salt from the water. It works by adding a chemical called CO2-responsive diamines to salt water. Yes, it's harmless. The diamine compound binds with the added CO2 and acts as a sponge and literally absorbs the salt out of the water, which can be then separated. The entire process takes only about 1 to as many as 10 minutes. That's it, folks. Once the CO2 is removed, the salt is released again, allowing the diamine to be reused many more times before it has to be discarded for a new material. In the laboratory, the method removed 99.6% of the salt in the seawater. The technology is still being developed so it can lower its price and optimize the recycling process. But it is also being tested on a small scale in the form of water bottles fitted with special filters that can be used in lifeboats and in other outdoor settings when you really don't have any other source of water. Ultimately, it could be used to greatly reduce the energy consumption of desalination plants as we move more and more towards less available clean water for all of us. For the last decade or so, we were actually moving more, at least here in the United States, and actually in the world, China, for instance, towards cleaner, more responsible water use. But then about two or three years ago, they gutted it again. They gutted the EPA, somewhere between 60, 70, and maybe even 100 laws, a lot of which had to do with clean water here in the United States. And even though they're saying, oh yeah, we got cleaner water and cleaner air, we do overall, especially from 20 years ago. But in the last three or four years, we've actually slipped backwards. We do need regulation, folks, because idiots will clean dirty. They don't care what they dump in your river if they're a chemical company or somebody else. If they're not held responsible for it, and they no longer are, then they don't care. They're worried about their purse 2 years down the road, not our children 7, 8, 10 years, and maybe a couple generations down the road. So yes, we need to be careful with our water. And that is, again, I can't not be political to some degree. Quit screwing up the earth. Well, while we're on the subject of water, as we'll do one not too nice a factoid again, but it's something that we are learning. And again, folks, we're part of the problem. We are part of this environment, and we're slowly learning in many, many cases much more involved as part of this ever-changing world than we thought we were. Marine life is moving the wrong way in a number of different situations. As the oceans have warmed in recent decades, a bunch of marine species like whales, corals, have begun to shift poleward. In other words, north if they're from one side, south from the other, moving to cooler waters. But a new study reported in the journal Nature Climate Change, yes, it's peer-reviewed, found that many sedentary species, especially things like snails, worms, mussels, clams, they are actually being transported in the wrong direction. What's happening is the bottom-dwelling species, we call them benthic species, they're there and they can't really control their direction except in very small areas. This has so far only been studied that I know of in the North Atlantic Ocean, but they're spawning earlier because the waters are warmer. But unfortunately, about the time they're spawning now is when the ocean currents are still moving southward. Those currents were shifting in another month or so, but these guys are already having their larvae before the direction of the water flow has changed. As a result, the larvae of these animals are now being carried into warmer waters every time rather than cooler ones. And that, of course, threatens their survival and it shrinks their range. They can't go the other way. They're not swimmers. They're benthic. They're stuck, more or less. These larvae grow into adults in these warmer regions and are basically just trapped there. They can't get back to the cooler water that they've evolved to be in. This creates a feedback loop where the situation for the species just gets worse and worse. Species like common sand dollars, who hasn't picked up a sand dollar if they've been to the beach? Oh, and more importantly, things like blue mussels, which have a great economic value. In the case of the blue mussel, their total range worldwide has been contracted, shrunk, moved, removed by as much as 50%, especially up in the Atlantic region. The result is a number of bottom-dwelling species that previously were quite abundant have entirely disappeared from areas of our outer shelf where we used to collect them, folks, for our well-being. The researchers at Rutgers University liken this wrong-way migration of bottom-dwelling marine life to a so-called, what we've called the elevator to extinction, which I've talked about before. This elevator to extinction is reminiscent of those species that live in the mountains. And as the mountains get warmer, those species keep moving up higher and higher elevations to escape the rising temperatures until they're at the top of the mountain. There's nowhere else to go, and that's as cool as they can get. The most interesting are some of the frogs, but they're indicator species, folks. Well, who cares about frogs? Well, the frogs are an indicator species. Amphibians are indicator species. And in certain mountains, especially the one I know about very well, I studied the entire extinction rate, was in Costa Rica on the mountains of a golden toad that went from numerous to gone in a matter of a decade or two. We have not seen another one, period, in the last 10 or 15 years. All gone just because of a couple degrees difference in that. And that what they did is they laid their eggs in mud puddles when on the rainy season. But the seasons changed and the frogs didn't change, so the mud puddles started drying up before the tadpoles could turn into toads and frogs, and there's nowhere else. They're at the top of the mountain. There's nowhere else to go. So yes, are we affecting climate? Are we affecting animals all the way around the world? Of course we are. Unfortunately, this all points to the essential fact that the research reveals is species don't necessarily move to places where the climate is more congenial for them. Some of them can't. Benthic species can't swim, folks. They can only go where the ocean tides take them. They may unfortunately end up migrating to even worse conditions where they can no longer reproduce. And finally, for this quarter, sort of something that a good friend of mine sent me a copy of just yesterday. She kind of keeps her nose to the grindstone, too, about what's going on. So she sent me an article about the fact that we're going to release here in the States, South Florida first, but then also here in Texas, Harris County, a genetically modified mosquito. And what that mosquito is supposed to do is it's been genetically modified to be sterile, and it's going to interbreed in the open. They're going to turn them loose by the millions. I think the ones in Florida, that one little area, is a 750 million. So almost 750 million of these mosquitoes. Now, they've made them sterile, so that what they do, they've done this. This is not new information. They did this with flies 50 or 60 years ago. The bots, the larvae of these flies, were called screwworms, and they were devastating to cattle populations and deer populations, and they basically wiped them out. Back then, they actually sterilized each fly, I think, when they were first learning to use lasers, and it worked. Okay, it was successful. I'm not sure how successful this particular situation is going to be. The problem is we don't know, and we're doing it without enough study. Mosquitoes, believe it or not, are a great food chain animal, especially for fish. They live on those larvae, especially for amphibians, and then it works its way up the food chain. The study really hasn't been done. What is going to happen if you wipe out billions of mosquitoes? Well, we're going to all say, oh boy, that's what we want to do. They carry disease. They sting us. Well, they bite us. They don't sting us. And only the females bite, incidentally. Males eat nectar. All right. But anyway, we haven't looked down that food chain. We're doing what we did with DDT. Let's use it and see what we kill. Let's use it and see what happens. Let's not do the study first. Well, we need to do the study first. We need to know what's going to happen when it happens. And you get somebody in business, they're making a bunch of money at it. They're selling that one set of mosquitoes to Florida for several million dollars already. So anyway, I'll keep my eyes on it. But what sounds good up front always has other background noise going on that we don't even know about. We haven't even studied them. And we'll be back after these messages with more of Organic Matters.